perhaps we should make a start. Welcome everyone to this term's Majewski lecture. I'm very pleased indeed to introduce Professor Gwilym Bekaneg, who's from the Open University. Been meaning to get him over here for a while now, so I'm very pleased that he was able to come today. He's an expert in modern Hinduism, and he's done research in modern Hinduism, particularly Vivekananda and Vivekananda's legacy. And he's got several publications, the last of which that I've seen was the one in a book on yoga today, edited by, I can't remember his name. So
it's Mark Singleton and Helen Goldberg.
That's right, yes. And he's going to talk to us today on renunciation and service, Swami Vivekananda's legacy, or the Ramakrishna Mutt and mission, Vivekananda Kendra and Swami Vivekananda's legacy. So, I'd like to extend a very warm welcome to you from OCHS, and I look forward to your lecture.
Thank you, Gavin. Thank you. I'd like to start by thanking the Oxford Centre for Hindu Studies for inviting me. I think many of us working on the Hindu tradition, often we work in isolation, and so it's very pleasant to actually go to a centre where there are several people sharing similar interests, and again, I look forward to obviously sharing my research this afternoon. My lecture falls into four sections. And just to explain, I think the first two are really an attempt simply to contextualise the angle, the approach I'm taking. So I'll try and race through those fairly quickly. The main focus of my work at present is on Vivekananda Kendra, this service organisation which has developed in South India since the 1970s. And so in planning my presentation, I have assumed a certain amount of general knowledge of Vivekananda and the Ramakrishna Mutt mission, so I won't go over all that. But I will assume probably little knowledge about Vivekananda Kendra. And I'm also going to include quite a few illustrations, because I want to make some points about the location. So if it feels like a travelogue at times, please bear with me, because I'm trying to make a particular point about how the Kendra have used their location in Kanyakumari. It's been suggested that we leave questions to the end, but can I just say, if I say anything about the Ramakrishna tradition which is unfamiliar, please stop me there and then, and I'll fill in enough so we can proceed. But I will, as I said, slow down when we get to the Kendra and linger over that. So the first introductory section is different readings of Vivekananda. And I start by just noting this is very timely because, of course, we've just finished the 150th birth anniversary, which has been celebrated globally, but with, I think, varying degrees of public attention. I think in the UK, very little public attention has been paid to it outside the movement. In the United States, far more in regions like California and Chicago, where Vivekananda visited and also has left much more of a deposit, if you like. Of course, in India, the anniversary was celebrated by the media, events sponsored by both central and state governments, by the UGC of India and other scholarly societies, and, of course, by movements inspired by him. And all of this, I think, is clearly indicative of Vivekananda's standing in India today. Now, scholarly judgments on Vivekananda are not just from people like me who have vested interest in promoting his studies, because that's how I spend most of my life, suggest a figure of considerable importance. And I just pause to outline some of the judgments passed. I mean, John Zavos, for example, has spoken about the Ramakrishna Mutt mission as providing a kind of template for other late colonial, post colonial Hindu movements. Torkel Brekker has talked about Vivekananda as the first of the global gurus. And my own former supervisor, David Smith, judged Vivekananda to have been one of the most important of all the modern gurus. And so I think from a scholarly point of view, regardless of, you know, popular acquaintance with Vivekananda, he remains a central figure. And the judgment which, in a sense, lies behind my presentation today, and in fact much of my current work, is one passed by Richard King, who asserted that Vivekananda's importance far outweighs his involvement with the Ramakrishna mission. So his wider importance actually extends way beyond the movement itself. And I think one can pinpoint four areas where this is obvious. The area in which I work, relating to Hindu notions of social activism, and particularly the growth of organized service, seva or seva. The second one is the development of modern yoga, and indeed phasing into New Age. And you'll find something of that in the volume of essays which Gavin's already referred to. The third one is the growth of Hindu nationalism in India over the last century. And the fourth one is the definition of Hinduism as a world religion, in inverted commas. And the two areas which actually interest me most are the issue of social activism and also the relationship between this and Hindu nationalism. And my excursion into yoga studies was very much under that heading. I make no claim at all to being a specialist in the yoga tradition. So these are areas where it's very difficult to avoid reference to Vivekananda and assessments of his influence. Yet recent critical scholarship has cast him very much as a contentious figure. And there's been a growing rift between the positions adopted by critical scholarship and the views of Vivekananda still cherished and promoted within the Ramakrishnamatam mission itself and by other admirers. And I think it's worth just noting here, of course, that many of the influential popular presentations of Vivekananda, which were very sympathetic, did come from outside the movement. I mean, Max Müller back in the 19th century is the obvious example, and promoted an image of Vivekananda and Ramakrishna, which is still, I think, respected and continually republished by the Ramakrishna mission itself. So what we see happening in the kind of modern critical scholarship is a questioning of the nature and the extent of continuity between Vivekananda and Ramakrishna, which of course has proved very distressing to the movement itself, and indeed the early Hindu tradition, and thus between the Ramakrishna movement, Vivekananda, and early Hindu tradition. Vivekananda has emerged much more as a figure pursuing his own agenda and raising in turn questions about the influences, if not Ramakrishna, which have shaped Vivekananda's own ideas, and thus the extent to which his agenda was different from that of his master. Now, I think this critical agenda underlies all the four areas which I've outlined above, but it also, I think, relates very much to the promotion of seva, which will be my focus today. Vivekananda's relatively short life ended within 5 years of his establishing in 1897 what would become the Ramakrishna mission. His plans for institutionalizing the delivery of service were very much, I would say, an unfinished project. And this was largely transformed into what we see today in the Ramakrishna movement after Vivekananda's death. And for that reason, most of my research, certainly over the last 20 years, has moved much more to Vivekananda in relationship to the Ramakrishna movement, and really not a great deal on the relationship between Ramakrishna and Vivekananda. And moving on from that, particularly Vivekananda's influence on other Hindu movements, if you like, his institutional legacy. Now, I think, in a way, almost paradoxically, and certainly maybe surprisingly, this shift in my own interest and my own approach came about partly as a result of my work on the Ramakrishna movement itself. Because if you look at the movement's own insider history, Swami Gambhirananda's history of the movement, you soon come across plenty of evidence of disputes centered on Vivekananda's interpretation of his own guru's teaching and priorities. And this is not something which critical scholars have had to look for. It's there in the movement's own self-understanding. Although, of course, it's rather smoothed over in terms of images like, well, Vivekananda was the one interpreter who was closest to the master, who could really get into Ramakrishna's intentions. That, of course, is rather a problematic claim. You'll also find this in Jeffrey Kripal's studies, not the Kali's Child, but I think in earlier articles, where he depicts very carefully the factionalism which you find in the early days of the movement, and indeed the different early attempts at biographies of Ramakrishna. There was never simply one picture, one account. I think what I've added to that is stressing that many of those who first responded to Vivekananda's own call to service, or reports of this in Indian newspapers, did this outside the Matan mission. And many of the movement's historic centres, in fact, were founded independently. Some of these later became recognised branch centres, but many did not. And so to this day, individuals and organisations function in India in Vivekananda's name, but completely independently of the Matan mission. And certainly in my part of the world, in the northwest of England, there's an organisation there created by largely Bengali consultants in the health service who are promoting the Vivekananda Ramakrishna mission, which has its own orphanages, you know, in Bengal. So we don't even need to go to India. We can find it in the UK as well. So it would seem that Vivekananda's impact from the outset, particularly at a symbolic level, was too broad to be contained even within the movement which he had founded. And subsequently, it has never been confined to one organisation or a single institutionalised line of transmission. So over the last decade, I have moved increasingly into exploring Vivekananda's importance for Hindu nationalist movements. And this really came, I think, simply as part of the process of appreciating the extent to which such movements also claim to be acting in Vivekananda's name. Beginning with the RSS, I have increasingly concentrated on the Vivekananda Kendra, and that's directed much of my research over the last 10 years, although I still work very much with the Ramakrishna Mata Mission as well. Now, apart from the fascination of working on some of these movements, and indeed being surprised by the way in which they use Vivekananda, I think this line of research has also led me to consider quite usefully certain overarching problems. The first of these is the extent to which the Ramakrishna Mata Mission should be considered as the guardian of the Ramakrishna Vivekananda tradition. The second question, and this is the one which is rather grabbing me at the moment, is the relationship between a movement like the Ramakrishna Mata Mission and, say, the RSS or Vivekananda Kendra. The latter are dubbed Hindutva movements, nationalist movements, and thus are often thought to be markedly different from the Ramakrishna movement to the point of having contradictory values. Yet one can see countless examples of cooperation between these movements. And I will come back to this in the body of the lecture. The gap between these movements, I would suggest, is not as great as sometimes publicly thought. The third point, which has come out of my research, is looking more closely at various depictions of Vivekananda as patriot, nationalist, architect of the nation, which emanate from movements that claim to have no involvement in political activity and frequently attribute this same position to Vivekananda. My first attempt at trying to conceptualise the uses made of Vivekananda by the RSS and the Kendra was to refer to this as appropriation. I moved away from that almost immediately, and I now refer to these simply as different readings, and readings with significant overlaps. And so again, during the course of the lecture, I'm not trying to imply that the Ramakrishna Mata Mission, the RSS and the Kendra are all the same. They're not. But there are, I think, considerable and significant overlaps in their interests and indeed the nature of their cooperation. Now, this kind of pattern of common elements coexisting alongside different emphases or even points of disagreement is hardly distinctive to Vivekananda and his legacy. One can find many examples of this in different religious traditions. In this instance, however, the nature of Vivekananda's legacy, and it's barely 100 years old, this is what so fascinated me by this movement when I first began to study it. Its history was so recent. Some of you might have read John Yale's book, A Yankee Among the Swamis, and he talked about feeling as if he'd gone back to Galilee in the early period of Christian history. I've met Swamis who knew the first generation of Ramakrishna's intimate disciples, and I visited Vivekananda's ancestral house before it was virtually torn down to be reconstructed. And there is a kind of immediacy here. And again, at the moment, I'm seeing it as I watch this other new movement, Vivekananda Kendra, take place in the south of India. So a lot of the kind of controversies, even over this relatively brief period, and the differences we're seeing emerging, I would suggest have some of their roots in the way which Vivekananda chose to represent himself at different points in his career and to different audiences. And these representations subsequently have been selected either singly or in different amalgams as inspirational by very different categories of devotees and admirers that have been drawn to him. This takes me on now to the second section. And this is Vivekananda representing himself. And again, I tend to present Vivekananda very much through iconography. So I apologize. Some of this is, you know, if you've seen some of my work, this will be familiar. But I'll move through it fairly quickly. This, of course, I suppose, is the most famous representation, the Chicago pose. Vivekananda photographed an image which then cropped, turned into a poster to publicize the World Parliament of Religions in 1893, after he made his initial splash there. What is interesting, I think, about this image and those that follow, of course, is all these were contrived, constructed in photographic studios. Vivekananda was very much complicit. He was active in the manufacturing, the composition of these representations, and often active in managing their distribution, which is why I think self-representation is the way to view this. Now, this pose, of course, is seen very much as a statement of his determination, his bearing, and his willingness to offer, one might say, an apology for Hinduism, or others might say a Hindu polemic, on the world stage to what might well have been an unsympathetic audience in Chicago. Now, this popular image is likely to be found in the public spaces of the Ramakrishna Mutt and Mission centers, but it's not installed for worship. And this leads us to the next image, which I created the title of the contemplative pose, because the movement itself hasn't actually labeled this. This was photographed in London at the behest of a devotee in 1896. And this is the image which, of course, as many of you will know, you will find installed for worship, both in Vedanta centers and beyond India, and, of course, in the many prayer halls and mandirs, you know, which form part of its centers in India itself. Now, possibly one reason for selecting this image is its symmetry with other representations of what is referred to as the spiritual trinity. And here, of course, we have three seated images. And, of course, again, part of the puzzle of all this is that the picture of Shraddha Devi was actually taken long after the death of Sri Ramakrishna. And so you find in a lot of the devotional pictures that there's a composite put together of the two, but in fact that was many years after Ramakrishna himself had died. So this image, let's go back, sorry. This image here, of course, is intended to sum up Vivekananda's universalistic and meditative contemplative qualities. And it certainly is very popular in Vedanta centers, beyond India. Now, we also know, of course, that Vivekananda changed his image fairly regularly as he travelled between India and America and Western Europe, 1897, looking very much like a Protestant clergyman later on in San Francisco. And, of course, some of this is clearly to do with the politics and the practicalities of moving between different regions and, of course, having to conform to the norms of the day and expectations. But I'd like to take it, somewhat beyond that, because I think it does bear down on the way the movement is found today. Because that same kind of difference, I think, is found in the way in which the movement represents itself beyond India and within India itself. So here, even if you this Vedanta temple in Hollywood, very much styled as a chapel, and of course there are ministers, Vedantin ministers. And this is very different, I would suggest, even from the prayer hall you find in the Ramakrishna, the Vedanta Center, Bourne End in this country, which is much more Indian in style. It's not the same as a mandir, but it's different again from this. So I suppose the question is this simply a matter of finding the right cultural clothing, as Christmas Humphreys wrote about the transplantation of Zen into Britain? Is there a core you can't lose? Do you have to re-clothe it appropriately when you move it? But I would say, again, it goes beyond this, because if we now look at the websites maintained by the movement, quite clearly they're not assuming one globalized audience. If you look at the website of the Belo Mutt, the movement's HQ, because based just outside Kolkata and Hara, which is designated the official website of the Ramakrishna Mutt and Mission, there is emphasis given to promoting the harmony of religions. And this is certainly a very strong note in the websites, if you go back again to the Vedanta Society of Southern California or indeed to the UK one. But against this, there is a much stronger emphasis, I would say, on Vivekananda as the modernizer of the Hindu tradition. and particularly his role in developing modern Hinduism and the nation in India, the nation of India. So beyond India, when operating in materially affluent countries, the Ramakrishna movement typically restricts its offering of service to teaching through publications, public lectures, and spiritual guidance given by members of the mat attached to these centres. For the most part, of course, in India, the movement's outreach is very much dependent upon its comprehensive service activities. Education, including publishing, health, rural development, including training and cultural activities. Therefore, on the Belur Mat website, there is a considerable prominence given to service activity, not least because, of course, the movement has to depend heavily on voluntary donations. Although I was talking to a researcher in one of its colleges recently who said now it was receiving more funding from the Indian government through grants than it was actually receiving through voluntary donations. But nevertheless, of course, it has to maintain this profile. So even allowing for a degree of necessary tailoring to the needs and the likely levels of prior acquaintance that could be assumed within and beyond India, the Vivekananda of the Indian wing of the movement is far more embedded in associations with building and modernizing both India and Hinduism. Crucially, Seva is intimately connected to this enterprise, and this dimension of his mission and legacy is best conveyed in this next image, which has little currency beyond India, but the gist of my lecture is that really this is the image now which really matters. Vivekananda, photographed possibly in Jaipur in 1891, again at the behest of a devotee. Again, it's very much a staged studio shot, and there are variations with different backgrounds. But what is interesting about this is the way in which it's been taken up and transformed into a painting. And the painting on the right is normally known as a painting by S.M. Pandit, who was very much involved in producing calendar art and film art. S.M. Pandit produced this painting, which is now known as Vivekananda of Kanyakumari. And what I'd like you to notice here, as I'll come back to this in a moment, is that this is the mainland behind, and I'll explain more about this in a moment. So, this painting has become very much associated with the creation of the Vivekananda Rock Memorial, which was created to mark the centenary of Vivekananda's birth in 1963. The memorial wasn't finished till 1970. And the campaign to construct this memorial was led by the RSS. The Ramakrishna Mat Mission were consulted throughout. When the campaign became politically sensitive because of the involvement of the RSS, the Ramakrishna Mat Mission dropped out and ceased to actively support it. But the memorial was concentrated by the president of the Mat Mission in 1970. So there was certainly an endorsement of it. Now, these different representations, the three I've shown you so far, they're not simply connected to place and to points in Vivekananda's lifetime. They're also intimately connected to what succeeding generations have sought from and taken from Vivekananda's legacy. And again, you can see this shift. If you look at the obituaries published on Vivekananda immediately after his death, it's almost all about his appearance in Chicago. And although we might think of him as a figure who has promoted Hindu activism, I think I've only found one substantial reference to that in the obituaries. By the time we come down to 1963, there's much more talk about Vivekananda as patriot and as the embodiment of service and renunciation. And this, of course, as I've just mentioned, was linked to this campaign for a national memorial. And I'll just skip this next bit, but I'll just say in passing, I think if you also now visit the restoration of Vivekananda's ancestral home, there's a website, you'll find, I think, now the mission, Ramakrishna Mission, also makes much more of Vivekananda's national role and the kind of tribute paid to the nation by him in raising this memorial. Now, in the Swami Vivekananda Centenary Memorial volume, which was published by the movement in 1963, there are different nuances relating to how Vivekananda's patriotism is presented. sometimes simply as a religion of humanity, also more specifically as India's nation builder. Now, I'll come on now to the main thrust of my talk, and I'll slow down now, because what I'm suggesting is that Kanyakumari is not just the geographical but also the symbolic locus of an important intersection of major strands discernible in Vivekananda's mission. From here we can both trace both overlapping readings of Vivekananda's life and significance by movements as seemingly diverse as the Mutton Mission, the RSS, and Vivekananda Kendra, and also the contours of the differences in their understandings of his mission, the philosophy of Seva, and the ends to which Seva service should be directed. So my thesis is we learn more about the power of Vivekananda's legacy today by approaching him as Vivekananda of Kanyakumari than through the more internationally known iconic image of the Chicago pose. So I come now to the next section, which is predictably Vivekananda of Kanyakumari. Now, this is like Chicago, one of these pivotal locations, moments in Vivekananda's career. But we only learn about this from Vivekananda retrospectively, 2 years after the event to which it referred, in a letter sent from Chicago in 1894 to one of his gurubais. Referring to his time in Kanyakumari at the very end of 1892, he wrote as follows. And this, of course, is the prospectus for his subsequent career. This vision he had of recreating India, using sannyasins to wander about, he says, teaching people science, education, development, not simply metaphysics. In the extended quote, he calls upon orthodox Hindus to raise the nation by teaching in this way. And he also evokes Ramakrishna's name as a source of the teaching, an empty stomach is no good for religion. So first you have to get the material level right so that people can move on and then focus on other things. And in this same letter, Vivekananda explains that's why he travelled to the United States, primarily to raise funds for this project. And we also find an early reference to him referring to offering America spirituality in return. Now, it's because of the importance of this location, of course, that when laying plans for a national memorial in the 1960s, the RSS determined to locate this at Kanyakumari. So, again, forgive me if this location is known to you, but I just want to make a couple of points about the way this location has been used by the movement. A small town of about population about 20,000, and what is significant about it, and I'll come back to this in a moment, is this vast campus now being developed by Vivekananda Kendra on the outskirts of the town. So that's what I'm working to. Kanyakumari functions as a pilgrimage centre, and it's also, I think, significantly a staging post on the winter route, on the route to the winter festival in Kerala, the Winter Ayyappan Festival, which draws thousands of people through Kanyakumari as they move onto Kerala. Lovely picture postcard here, Sunrise Beach. And famed for its spectacular sunrises and sunsets, you know, tourists and pilgrims alike take the darshan of the motherland by standing on this beach early in the morning. This has now been referred to as the Kanyakumari experience, and the town is being increasingly marketed as a tourist destination. But we also find many different levels of religious institutions there. We have the temple to Devi Kanyakumari, which is a shoreline temple. More recently, in the 1950s, the memorial to Mahatma Gandhi, whose ashes were sprinkled off the shore. But this, of course, leads us to what's happened since the 1960s, where we have now the rock memorial, which is the further of the two rocky outcrops there, and now dwarfed since 2000 by an immense statue of the Tamil poet, legendary figure, Tiruvallur. So Kanyakumari is very much a kind of heritage centre, I would suggest, as well as being a kind of traditional pilgrimage centre. Now, the fact that Kanyakumari now contains the HQ of an increasingly important Hindu service organisation, Vivekananda Kendra, has strengthened its position as a pilgrimage, heritage and tourism centre, but it's also allowed the Kendra to offer the Kanyu Kumari experience when promoting its own events. So you come on one of our training events, you can also experience Kanyu Kumari and receive its darshan. Now, the establishment of the Rock Memorial has popularized and strengthened a mythical account of Vivekananda swimming through the dangerous currents from the mainland to the rocky outcrop where he meditated for 3 days and where this memorial is now located. And if you go to the Rock Memorial and you go inside the memorial hall and you see the statue of Vivekananda, it's inscribed on the base. This is what he did. He swam out there. He then meditated for 3 days. And in the standard biography of Vivekananda produced within the movement by his Eastern and Western disciples, it states that it was here Vivekananda meditated on the future of India as, in quotes, a master builder might look at an architect's plans. In the process, being transformed from a single-minded monk, again in quotes, into a reformer, nation builder, and world architect. Now, the first edition of this biography was produced within 10 years of Vivekananda's death. And the sixth edition, which is the one, you know, about the most recent one, attributes knowledge of Vivekananda's time on the rock to eyewitnesses, one of whom had reported this to Swami Virajananda, who was responsible for producing this biography, when he visited Kanyu Kumari in 1919. But this is a somewhat problematic account, and it's problematic for a number of reasons. And this has been looked at closely by Rajagopala Chattopadhyay in his critical biography of Vivekananda, where he points out that Vivekananda himself only spoke of meditating in the temple itself, which is on the mainland. Vivekananda was quite explicit. He sat in the mother's temple, and that's where his meditation took place. There's also the problem about whether in December, Vivekananda, who was not in the best of health, could actually have made this swim. And if he'd got there, and if indeed he was there for 3 days, and he'd swum, presumably partly dressed, how would he have got dry clothes? How would he have survived in what was a very exposed location for 3 days? And I think, again, this is why I drew your attention to the Vivekananda Kanyu Kumari portrait, because what we see there is very much Vivekananda on this outcrop looking back to the mainland. And there's actually a slight silhouette of the goddess temple behind him, in front of him, rather. So this is a slightly inconsistent narrative. And Chattopadhyay suggests, in fact, that it arose out of the original biographer's ignorance of the geography and that they simply confused two things. But this narrative has now certainly taken root. And what it's done, of course, is to promote a particular image which has been strengthened by the creation of this monument. It's now a kind of almost self-reinforcing cycle. The account of the swim to the offshore rock is revealing for a number of reasons. First of all, in his Eastern and Western disciples, we have this use of language. It's here that he viewed the nation like a master builder, this notion of the architect of the nation. And that's the kind of language which has been picked up in the RSS and in the Kendra itself. This is the kind of language. Also, though, I would suggest that the three roles they pick out in life, the role of reformer, nation builder, and world architect, correspond quite closely to the three iconographic representations which I started with. Now, if the narrative of the swim has been manufactured, there's no evidence that Vivekananda took any part in this. I mean, I think it happened in the decade after his life. But if this narrative does lack a historical basis, then of course the location of the Rock Memorial and the campaign for its construction does indeed rest on a very questionable account. But as I said now, I think there's a reinforcing kind of interest in maintaining this view and not actually questioning it. So that is the Rock Memorial. It's an elaborate complex, and although, as I said, it's dwarfed by the statue on the adjoining rock, that is simply provides a vantage point where tourists can climb to the top and look back, whereas here you've got the Rock Memorial itself, various vantage points. You've got the Memorial Hall also erected over what's believed to be the footprint of the goddess, Kanyu Kumari, And also you have other services. So this is much more of an elaborate complex. And it's one which, in fact, draws a large number of people. And I'll come back to that in a moment. And in the hall itself, again, we have, as one might expect, the Vivekananda as wandering ascetic, Vivekananda of Kanyakumari image, which is established there. So I just want now to talk very briefly about the centre which the Kendra has built at Vivekanandapuram, right on the town limit. And this is, and I just want to touch on this briefly because I think it indicates the power of this movement. It's got an extensive 100-acre campus. It also, in fact, provides the best route to the sunrise beach. So this guarantees a constant flow of pilgrims and tourists passing through its campus to get to this beach where, as I said, the morning it certainly draws people as a place for meditation and reflection. It also has a considerable amount of accommodation. It can house 1,000 people at a time. Contains large halls, a library, training centres, shop services. It has one mandir already built and one under construction, which is going to be dedicated to the Ramayana, and it's also going to offer a 27-foot granite statue of Hanuman. This is very much a nationalist project ongoing, and HQ, standing exhibitions, and so forth. So here we have the campus itself, not drawn to scale, but it's very difficult to capture it visually because it is very, very dispersed. But the point about its location between beach and road is absolutely crucial. I was there 2 months ago, and one of the outcomes of the 150th was there's now been a statue erected to Vivekananda as a Mason by the Masons of India. I'm not quite sure why they chose this campus. I'm meaning to get back to the leaders of the Kendra to ask them about that. But they've also the Masons of India have also erected a small hospital on the campus as well. So it's another perspective of how Vivekananda is viewed as Brother Mason, as clearly someone who's very much seen in terms of building the nation, the architect of the nation. And finally, another, I think, intriguing visual, which is not quite so clear here, but we have here the samadhi of the founder of the Kendra, and I'll say more about him in a moment, which is aligned in such a way that you can see through that to the statue of Vivekananda, which in turn then is aligned with the rock memorial itself. So it's actually, you know, it's quite a powerful location, and again, it draws people to see this kind of cumulative, I suppose, valuing of Vivekananda. So, as I said, forgive the travelogue, but I wanted to make a point about how the movement has exploited this environment, this very evocative location, and it's added its own kind of meaning to this. Now, geography actually throws further light on the Kendra, Vivekananda Kendra's sense of its own mission. Its centres are heavily concentrated on three regions. Those of the Ramakrishna Mutton mission tend to be clustered in areas where Vivekananda himself was most active. The Kendra's concentration is in the Kanyakumari district of Tamil Nadu itself, South India. It's also active in Maharashtra, where this is the heartland of support for the RSS. And it's also very active along India's northeast border region, particularly in Arunachal Pradesh. And this is part of the Kendra's attempt to bolster Hindu identity on this fragile border area, reflecting concerns both about the security of the border and also about the impact of Christian missions in this remote area. Now, the decision to concentrate on the northeast border region in Assam and Arunachal Pradesh was made by the Kendra's founder, Eknath Ranade, and it remains a key feature of the movement's service strategy. It also represents, the Kendra suggests, its national scope, stretching from the remote northeast down to Kanyakumari. It's all India. That's just a very brief couple of captions about the size of the movement today, 700 branch and project centres. Let's remember that the Ramakrishna Mutton Mission, very much associated with this legacy of service, manages about 130 centres. And of course, if it moves into the RSS, then there's massive numbers of additional centres here. current centres, again, I would draw particular attention to its use of creches, because the Kendra, in fact, has certainly drawn very strongly on women for its leaders. One of its presidents, one of its three national presidents to date, has been a woman. Several of the regional organisers are women, and it uses the creches, again, to train women and to bring them forward into leadership roles. So, for the last general report, 80,000 visited the centre itself. Over 2 million people visited the Rock Memorial. It's getting a considerable exposure. Now, the movement itself, the Kendra, proclaims its indebtedness to Vivekananda through its name. But within the movement also, they talk about having two mothers, the Ramakrishna Mission and the RSS. And so I tend to play with this notion of this dual maternal descent to get some idea of the way in which these traditions are blended and how we get to what I've called these overlapping readings. You get a very good example of this. I'll move on to that in a moment. If we look at the bedroom of the founder, Eknat Ramadev, which is still maintained as a kind of memorial, it's not a shrine, it's there for people simply to visit. And here we have on the wall Vivekananda next to the second supreme leader of the RSS, Golwalkar, who was very closely involved with Ramadev. They worked very closely within the RSS together. So this is not seen as contradictory. This is seen to be, if you like, complementary. Now, it was Golwalkar who gave Ramadev, who was previously a general secretary of the RSS, the twin tasks of popularising Vivekananda's message as part of the centenary celebration of the 1960s, and also leading the campaign for a national memorial. Now, Ramadev consulted the Ramakrishna Mutton Mission regularly throughout this campaign, although, as I said, when it became politically sensitive, the Mutton Mission then withdrew. The Kendra was founded in 1972 on the back of the momentum generated by this Rock Memorial national campaign. And it continues to manage the memorial and therefore to benefit from the charges paid by the visitors. Ramadev was a highly effective organiser. He was not so much of an ideologue. And it's said that he came to appreciate the extent to which the RSS was held in suspicion as he fundraised nationally through India for a project to celebrate Vivekananda, which otherwise should have had a good deal of popular support. And if we look at his correspondence from 1965 onwards, which is 5 years before the memorial was finished, it's clear he'd begun to consider establishing an independent movement. The speed at which the Kendra was established and also functioned, own HQ, journals, training program for its own life workers, between 1972 and 1973, clearly bear out this idea that Ranelagh had planned this extremely well, and the plans were well advanced before we get to the 1970s. Again, Ranelagh sought advice from within the Ramakrishna movement, and Swami Ranganathananda, a very influential Swami in the Ramakrishna Mutt, was influential in advising Ranelagh to create a lay service organisation. So these are not movements which are, if you like, separated by a huge ideological difference. There are overlaps and there are supportive relationships. Ramadev himself, this image of activism and dynamism, which is how he's celebrated very much in the movement. I said he's not regarded as a guru. He's regarded as a revered figure, certainly. And responsible for three principles which guide the movement today. The first of these is that from Vivekananda you have this very strong emphasis upon service, but it's service which does have a spiritual orientation. It is a sadhana, it's not simply service, in a kind of secular sense. Secondly, the Kendra is a cadre-based and not a guru-centered organisation. I'll come back to that later on. And it kind of claims itself to be an extraordinary organisation built up ordinary men, ordinary people. Well, I've just repeated their language there. And I think it is important that both men and women are admitted for training to enter the cadre, and as I said earlier, women have held senior positions of responsibility. And in this sense, there is a contrast to both the, obviously, male Ramakrishna Mutt, and also indeed the RSS, which itself only admits men. I mean, some of its affiliates admit women. So the Kendra prides itself on being a non-sannyasi order, again, that's its phrase, in which the saffron robe is internalised. Now, this is very much part of its ethos. Also, this is how I got to be in the yoga book, which I mentioned at the start. Yoga within the Kendra is seen as a service activity. Offering yoga is part of its popular outreach activity. So it's not seen as something separate from service. Promoting teaching yoga is a key feature of its service activity, and promoting with this its yoga way of life. So the translation of Vivekananda's ideas about service, you know, into the Vivekananda Kendra certainly come in part through the RSS, and this is the second line of descent. And again, I've written quite a bit about this in the past, so I'll just touch on this very briefly. That the key figure again here is Golwalkar, the second leader of the RSS, who himself, in fact, abandoned the RSS briefly in the 1930s, strongly attracted to Swami Akandananda, one of Vivekananda's closest supporters and most involved in promoting service within the Ramakrishna Mutton Mission. Golwalkar went to Bengal to get initiation, and certainly with the intention, seemingly, of gaining admittance to the Ramakrishna Mutt. And I consulted members of the Mutt on that, and that's been confirmed. But Akandananda died suddenly, and just after Golwalkar had been initiated. And so at that point, Golwalkar then returned to his former life in the RSS. And in time, in fact, he became its leader. Although he'd been exposed to Swami Akandananda's influence, he did not immediately adopt a life of service. And this only happened in the 1950s, after the RSS had fallen into disrepute and indeed had been proscribed for a year following the assassination of Gandhi. But when Golwalkar began to reform and re-energize the RSS in the 1950s, he then adopted the notion of positive Hinduism. And with this, service was given a new prominence. And this was not simply the kind of paramilitary service of earlier decades, but the kind of more rounded form of service which we now associate with, you know, Hindu movements committed to this. Crucially, what Golwalkar did to transform Vivekananda's message was to challenge the idea that service should be offered to the individual as divine. The crucial shift here, taking Vivekananda's notion of serve the needy as God, serve the impoverished as God. Instead, Golwalkar said this was too broad an ideal. Instead, our people should be the focus. Our people is our God, Golwalkar argued. So in his system, Vivekananda's living God, the object of service, the individual or humanity, becomes the divine within our people or nation. Again, I quote from him here from Bunch of Thoughts. The supreme vision of Godhead in society is the very core of our concept of nation and has permeated our thinking and given rise to various unique concepts of our cultural heritage. Now, Ranadeh, although a close associate of Golwalkar while in the RSS, was not so closely associated with the Ramakrishna Mutton Mission. He had studied Vivekananda while a student, and he held Vivekananda in deep respect as a patriot. And this attitude was strengthened when he was involved in working towards the centenary celebrations. But what Ranadeh brought to this particularly, or rather, I suppose, gave fresh emphasis to, was action infused with a sense of urgency. And Ranadeh used the phrase constantly, the need of the hour, the need for wakefulness or alertness. And we find him using this when India was facing conflict with Pakistan in the 1960s. And let's be clear, you know, Ranadeh was urging that Hindus needed to strengthen their sinews because there was conflict with Pakistan. This was not just simply an inattitude. But also we find this need of the hour language used to talk about addressing broader challenges facing contemporary Indian society, whether disaffection of the young, materialism or whatever. The Kendra still uses this kind of language. So it's the existential crisis, not so much of the individual, but the crisis facing the nation, which this movement and its founder attempted to address. Now, this call to India has been recently reiterated by one of the Kendra's current vice presidents, Niveda Tabide, who is a really charismatic figure. As I said, this is not a movement which has gurus, but when she's there, the devotees flock to her and take pranam. It's a very different relationship to that with the other president and vice presidents. Recently, she kind of reiterated this call, this need for urgency, linked to Vivekananda's repeated exhortation, arise, awake, and stop not until the goal is reached. And this language is so much part of the Ramakrishna Matan Mission's literature, which, of course, in turn echoes verses in the Katha Upanishad. So certainly in my own work on the Kendra, I very much emphasize this intense activism the movement tries to engender, and also this sense of national urgency. Ranade declared, that service is best and the noblest which is performed with the attitude of total surrender to God. Consequently, although service, seva, is given the status, again, of a sadhana, a spiritual discipline in the Kendra, the development of the individual, nevertheless, is seen to be instrumental in preparing that individual to serve the nation and humanity. It's not an end in itself. For, and this is Ranade again, at the core of the Kendra's activities are man-making, nation-building, and national reconstruction. So the Kendra's response to this challenge, the need of the hour, has been to build an organisational life upon the theory and practice of Karma Yoga, as laid down by Ranade, who drew heavily in this respect upon Vivekananda. And if you look at the Kendra's prayer, which is recited daily by the life workers in their early morning meditation, they declare themselves to have deep faith in the chosen path of Karma Yoga, and they pray that they may achieve their goal through their renunciation, service, and self-knowledge. Interesting to compare their prayer with that of the RSS. This is accompanied by chanting of those sections of the Gita that deal specifically with Karma Yoga. And again, I would relate this, if you like, as part of an ongoing process from the development of notions of Karma Yoga, you know, in contemporary Hindu movements, which Ashoka King tracked some years ago, this ideal of the Karma Yogin. Professor King identifies Vivekananda as the first to recognize the religious significance of Karma Yoga, the Karma Yogin, although clearly he was not the first to formulate this idea. And again, according to Omiyo Asen, only Bunkim Chandra before Vivekananda had suggested that Karma Yoga could be an independent way to salvation. Now, one of the most important features of Vivekananda's understanding of Karma Yoga was flexibility. And again, Professor King has pointed this out, and it's kind of consistent with my presentation, that Vivekananda spoke of Karma Yoga in terms of service very much in India. Whereas in the United States and London, he tended to emphasize Jnana Yoga, religion, spirituality, wisdom, rather than Karma Yoga, service and action. And as I said, I think this representation continues to the present day. One of my favorite stories about Ranade, and this is an anecdote, but it's the movement is always passing this on. He said to have likened Karma Yoga to dal, a staple part of the diet, and not a seasoning taken at choice, you know, with a meal. So in prioritizing Karma Yoga over the self-realization of the individual, however this is understood metaphysically, the Kendra could point to a comparable responsibility that Ramakrishna is popularly believed to impose upon Vivekananda. Remain in the world, be a banyan tree, and let others come to you. But there's a significant difference between that account of Ramakrishna urging Vivekananda to remain within the world for the benefit of others and their path to liberation, and the Kendra's advocacy of Karma Yoga as a means to nation building. So the Kendra's mixed maternal descent is apparent in that. It's also apparent, I think, in their use of Vivekananda's teaching about the spiritual core of India and spiritual nationalism. In a talk entitled Tolerance and Love, Ranade explained that the Kendra took Vivekananda's name, firstly, because its formation, the movement's formation, grew out of the commemoration of the birth centenary of this, I quote, noble patriot of our motherland, and secondly, because Vivekananda's name stands for a universality which transcends all parochialism. His mission is as expansive as the sky. Ranade declared that the Kendra's aspiration is to provide a meeting place for all the multifarious spiritual forces in the country for the cause of the nation. warning against the dangers of fanaticism and sectarianism. Yet while insisting that the Kendra does not speak disparagingly of any sect or person, and commending constructive work, liberality of attitude in order to understand others, and the need to spread sweetness and love everywhere, again his phrase, he referred exclusively to the internal diversity of the Hindu tradition, a sharp distinction between religions of Indian origin and, in quotes, religions that originated abroad, is maintained by the Kendra's current president, Parameshwaran. And Professor Prale Kanungo, who's specialised in this area, has observed that the Kendra is committed to promoting both a form of ecumenical Hinduism and Hindu nationalism. And again, we see that kind of idea at work here in a poster on display at Vivekananda Kendra. It's headquarters. This idea of a national union of India, gathering up of scattered spiritual forces. Now, this is taken from Vivekananda himself, his lecture, The Common Bases of Hinduism. And it's evident in this lecture that he too walks something of a tightrope between trying to gather together people while also distinguishing between India's spiritual core, and again, this is his language, barbarians bringing barbarous religions into India with their threat of violence to Hindus. And in this respect, as I've shown elsewhere, Vivekananda was very much a man of his time. He shared, for example, with the founder of the RSS common concerns about the threat posed by colonialism and Christian and Muslim conversion to the very survival, not just of Hindus, but of Hindus as a majority in India. I was quite surprised when I found that one. He was more generous in his acknowledgements of what he regarded as the positive achievements of Islam and Christianity, but he was nevertheless vehement in his criticism of the fanaticism and violence for which he believed Islam was responsible. So this quotation taken from The Common Bases of Hinduism is, I think, a very important one. And Peter van der Veer has also chosen it to illustrate the way in which Vivekananda's use of spirituality links up to the notion of yoga being at the core of Indian superconsciousness, Hindu spirituality, and the way in which this discipline, this spiritual discipline, in turn has been taken up and used by nationalist organizations. He argues that Vivekananda's construction of spirituality is crucial to the notion that one can be a renunciant and still be active in political and social causes, suggesting that Hindu nationalism could hardly exist without such a notion. So we find that Vivekananda uses spirituality in a number of ways, frequently as a synonym for religion, but particularly to refer to religion informed by direct experience, that which dynamizes religion and which makes it meaningful. And I'm sure this is something he would have imbibed from Ramakrishna. It's also consistent with Vivekananda's own theory of dynamic religion, and I would suggest that lies at the heart of his more widely celebrated theory of practical Vedanta. Practical Vedanta is often represented as a rationale for service, but if you read it carefully and you also read how the early journals of the Ramakrishna mission referred to practical Vedanta, you'll find it's all to do with experientially based dynamic religion. It is not in itself an explicit advocacy for service. Seeing God, realizing the spirit, this is practical religion, Vivekananda wrote. And his argument moved on from this foundation to assert that there can be no regeneration for India until you be spiritual. Religion for a long time has come to be static in India. What we want is to make it dynamic. A year later, this is 1898, Vivekananda was interviewed on much the same subject by Prabuddha Bharat. This is one of the first journals still running in the movement now. The distinguishing feature of his movement, Vivekananda replied to the questioner, was aggression. Aggression in the sense of trying to flood the world with Hindu spirituality. He was also concerned with promoting national efficiency, meaning here eradicating superstition and bringing Hindus together through defining the common bases of Hinduism. When asked to characterize his methods of action, Vivekananda replied, "It simply consists in reasserting the national life. The secret lies here. The national ideas of India are renunciation and service. Intensify her in these channels, and the rest will take care of itself. The banner of the spiritual cannot be raised too high in this country. In it alone is salvation." Writing in a special issue of the Kendra's journal, Vivekananda Kendra Patrika, to commemorate the birth centenary of Golwalkar, the second leader of the RSS, with whom Ranade had worked so closely, the current president of the Kendra referred to Vivekananda as the inspiration behind Golwalkar's work, and how both espoused the cause of spiritual nationalism, suggesting in the course of his argument that spiritual nationalism and Hindu nationalism are one and the same. Parameshwaran refers to the seminal ideas of spiritual nationalism as Swamiji's gifts to India's freedom movement, namely, concept of Bharat as the universal mother, total self-sacrifice to her service, positive ideas about national reconstruction. Yet having claimed that Vivekananda spoke for Mother India as a whole and represented Indian cultural and spiritual quest and achievement in its totality rather than a particular sect, Parameshwaran adds a gloss to Vivekananda's call for a national union of India's scattered political forces. He dismisses as, in quotes, a far-fetched political interpretation any identification of Vivekananda's call for the combination of an Islamic body and a Vedantic brain. This is one of the great refrains, of course, in Vivekananda. Any call for the combination of an Islamic body and a Vedantic brain as a call for Hindu-Muslim unity, Parameshwaran just rejects that outright. He says, what Swamiji wanted was the national union of all those whose hearts beat to the same tune. This was basically a spiritual prescription. So there are limits to what we include and what we include out. So to take this as a cry for Hindu-Muslim unity, he wrote, was simply a far-fetched political interpretation. So I come now to my conclusion, which is very brief. Vivekananda Kendra provides an intriguing illustration of one way in which Vivekananda's influence has come to be woven in complex ways into a different institutional legacy outside the remit of the Ramakrishna Mutton mission. Constantly maintaining that his concern lay only with the spirit and not with politics, and this is a boundary publicly endorsed again in different ways by the Ramakrishna movement, the RSS and the Kendra, Vivekananda identified spirituality as the one national idea of Hindus, and as we noted above, with renunciation and service. Those who heard Vivekananda's message in the late 1890s in the United States and London clearly took a different emphasis from this than that invested in it by those who are focused on reviving Hinduism and by this means nation building in India. As I observed earlier, the Ramakrishna Mutton mission tends to vary its emphasis when addressing its Indian and beyond India followings. Vivekananda's conjunction of ideas concerning spirituality and national union might legitimately be regarded as having laid part of the groundwork for those like Golwalkar, whose preoccupations with physical strength and national will or spirit was suggestive of a far more fully fledged understanding of ethnic nationalism, probably informed by some degree of acquaintance with expressions of European nationalism. Yet Vivekananda's ideas were distinct from those of Golwalkar, in particular the priority which Vivekananda placed on making religion practical and dynamic through direct experience of realizing God or spirit, is not replicated in the RSS. Although the implications of reviving Hinduism as a basis for promoting a particular understanding of Indian national unity are. In common with many children, the Kendra, the offspring of two mothers, does not display all of its parents' most recognisable characteristics. It has selectively assimilated and blended some of them. In rejecting the model of a sannyasi-led organisation, the Kendra has abandoned a key feature of Vivekananda's original strategy. Its admission of women life workers and stress upon its lay credentials, however, may prove to have a broader appeal in 21st century India. This is another feature that also, I mentioned earlier, marks it out from the RSS. So too is the way in which the Kendra has adopted, following Vivekananda's example, a collective commitment to the sadhana of service, and not what some within the RSS, its other mother, have spoken of as its distinctive sadhana, namely that provided through participation in the daily branch meetings of the RSS, where from the time of its founding, sport and ideological discussion have been used as methods of character building. The Kendra, like the RSS, strives to promote the goals of Hindutva ideology, but its understanding of spirituality is far wider than that of the RSS, and the training of its cadre reflects this. This might suggest that the Kendra's members are engaged upon a Shadana which is not narrowly conceived as being fulfilled by the creation of a Hindu Rashtra, while being instrumental to the same. The Kendra's relationship to its two mothers, both of whom have been profoundly touched by Vivekananda, I would suggest is a further illustration of the complexity of the courses through which Vivekananda's influences have flowed over the last century and more, crisscrossing with others and constantly being reshaped and renewed, and I suppose inviting us to evaluate whether this is a reinvigoration or a dilution of Vivekananda's original message. And I end there. And thank you very much for your interest.
Thank you, Professor Bekele, for sharing your thoughts. It's interesting how Vivekananda, how different contemporary groups claim Vivekananda, how this complexified that picture for us. So I open the room for questions or comments.
You said that Vivekananda, depending upon the audience, he expressed differently.
Yes.
In one of the letters, can't remember the dates. He does write. He says in the West, the society, the people in society have freedom, but yes, not in religion.
Yes.
What it was in India, we had the freedom in religion, but not in society.
Yes.
So in trying to bring, to arouse the Indians to be what they want to be and not be confused as to who they are, he had to have a different approach when he talked in India at the time of the British Empire.
Yes.
That's what I was trying to get at.
Yes. I think, if you don't mind, I'll move forward, actually, now I'm finishing this. I think also I tend to place a lot of emphasis myself on the brevity of Vivekananda's life.
Yes.
I think he was, he wasn't a man still trying to find a mission. But I think many of the complexities we see now and some of the contradictions result from the fact that he died, as I said in the talk, within 5 years of having returned to India in 1897. I think certainly some of the rough edges and the lack of system is the result of that.
Because there are some letters of Vivekananda. He writes beautifully to somebody, but we don't know what the reply was. So a lot of that what we know about him is through his letters.
Yes.
And hence the picture becomes incomplete because they have no reply.
I think that's right. And also, of course, we don't know when the actual ideas took shape. I kind of seized on a letter. I said in 1894, Vivekananda said this. But for all I know, he might well have spoken avidly about this experience in 1892 to all kinds of people. But I don't think there's any documentary evidence of him referring to it before 1894, which after all is 2 years on after what is meant to be probably the seminal pivotal moment when his mission took shape in India. I mean, the Ramakrishna movement at the moment is re-editing all of Vivekananda's work, and they produced the 150th edition of his works, which in fact have started to fill in some of the gaps in the letters, but the full revision is not going to be out for, I think, a few years yet. I haven't had a chance to test to what extent we get more insights into the correspondence in this new edition.
I think some of these constructions are so terribly polemical that I always wonder, whether anyone who uses this kind of language, whether in the Kendra or the Vivekananda earlier, ever thinks about the actual content of these definitions of spirituality or of spiritual nationalism. What is actually the content of this? How can this possibly be translated into activity, into seva, and how far is this really construed at a period of time when you really had very strong East-West opposition? It's not a kind of universal world, or it's not a globalized and planetized world like the one we live in today. So do these ideas really still make sense in a contemporary globally oriented society? That is my question. But also the question is how far in their original formulation there is a lack of definite content of these concepts.
Yes, I think that's it. I think this is, in a sense, I suppose I hinted at that, because Ranade certainly was not an ideologue. And if you have reason to look at and what he's left behind. And Kendra is starting to publish this material now. And so far we've got one very substantial volume of his correspondence.
This is Ramadi.
Yeah, which is fascinating, because if like me, you've been trying to track how this all comes through, you can actually track it very easily through his correspondence. But this is not setting out a philosophical position. Mm-hmm. And I think in a sense he's very much dependent upon Goldwater, I think. And I used a quotation from Jyotirmaya Sharma recently in his book on Goldwater, where he talked about even Goldwater really was doing little more than, I think he called it, intelligent pamphleteering. He was addressing the existing membership of the RSS, and he said what he was doing is he was going back to Sarvakatu Vivekananda, to Dayananda. He wasn't adding much to it. Mm-hmm. And I think that probably maybe underestimates what I think is the important shift which you find in this understanding of the object of service. I think there is a very clear shift where Goldwater rejects the idea of service to the individual. He doesn't reject it, but he says service to the individual being is just too broad. He says it's led to inaction. Service must have a national focus, and it must galvanize the country. And so we get this idea of, you know, nation is, God is embodied in the nation rather than the Vivekananda sense of the individual. So I mean, I think that gets picked up. But I mean, what I would add to that is that I've been working as closely as I've been able to with the Kendra since about 2006, and I've talked to a lot of their people. And two things come across constantly. I mean, again, I am excited by the recency of this formation and what I think is its dynamism today. But I'm still dealing with people there, the first generation of its leaders, who knew the Fambo. And I try talking to them and saying, okay, so what you got you into this? Was it Ranelagh's inspiration? Oh, no, I've never heard of him. What we did, we were actually devotees of Vivekananda. And at some point or other, maybe in their university or in their town, Ranelagh gave a talk, or they came across his writings, and that clicked. And for some of them, clearly it was to do with the way in which they could become life workers without actually going down the traditional path and becoming a sannyasi. And again, I've talked to some of the women leaders, and they've been quite frank about this. And they said, in my family, I couldn't have done that to my parents. I could not have done that. But I could become a life worker, because the Kendra insisted, first of all, that all their life workers have to be graduates. And also, they have to be able to show they have no family responsibilities left. So if they're a single child, maybe the responsibility for their parents, at that stage, they are not admitted to the cadre. What they can do is they can join for a short time. They can do maybe 2 years of service, see if the life is for them. And also, they can go back in retirement. There are various categories of workers, but I mean, the core of the cadre are people who go in their mid-20s and 30s, and the test is meant to be they are graduates and they have given something up. What they've given up, actually, is the prospect of a graduate career. That is their sacrifice. They really do sacrifice this kind of material prospect. And I mean, the politics of the Kendra clearly is problematic. But I've got to say, I've been exposed to a lot of these people, and individually, I find a lot in them to respect. I mean, the austerity of their lives, and also, I think, the way in which they are held in respect by the Kendra's, you know, wider following, is quite telling. They very much live out this claim that they are non-sannyasi, and also part of the wider argument is that as lay workers, both women and men, they can relate far better to the bulk of the population than an all-male sannyasi order around Krishnamurti, which might be deeply respected and deeply revered. But if you've got a real problem in life, who are you going to talk to? And their claim is that they're more people in the villages are more likely not to be intimidated by them, and in fact, and they work alongside them very closely. So, I mean, I don't doubt the personal sacrifice which some of these bike workers have made, and they have interesting you know, roots into the movement and different expectations. I mean, some have come in through Gandhian cooperative experiments and so forth. Some have spent their whole life, working in various development schemes. I remember talking to one senior worker who ended his conversation by saying, well, perhaps in a few years we won't be Vivekananda anymore. You know, we're not guru-led. What we are an extraordinary organisation of ordinary people. I was slightly teasing him because he had a poster on his wall from that famous indigenous American leader.
Billy Graham?
No, it's often trotted out in kind of stuff on ecology through the environment. And I was just saying, well, you're obviously very globalised. You've got all this up here.
Well, he was a deputy.
Yeah.
Al Gore.
Sorry?
Al Gore.
No, an indigenous American Indian.
Al Gore.
Indigenous
American. Yeah, and I'm sorry, the name escapes me.
Yeah.
It's one of these.
Chiefs, yeah.
Thank you so much. It was Chief Seattle, that's right. And it's one of these posters you often find. But it was there. It was in the office of this leader of a movement, which is meant to be really, really quite kind of narrow and so forth. And it was kind of testing the waters. But the thing is, I think because they're involved in ecology and they're also involved in sustainable development, their networks out from that movement into the wider debate about ecology, I think it is broadening. And when he said, well, maybe in a few years' time. We won't even need to have Vivekananda. I could see what he was getting at. It was interesting. I couldn't imagine a member of the Mutt saying that to me.
You never mentioned anything about the Sharda Act.
Yeah,
I was sister.
Yes.
Because they have, but even there, there is Sharda movement, which is under the Belur Mutt.
Yes.
But also Sharda ashrams, which are only affiliated, but they're not under the control of the Belur Mutt.
Yes.
At all, and there's such movements all exist right throughout.
Indeed.
And again, these people are all graduates.
Indeed,
but
I think
up a huge amount of.
This is certainly where the women life workers in the Kendra were making their point of comparison. This is not a way of life either I would choose for myself, or indeed I would not be able to commit at this point because of family. Mm-hmm. But I think the ethos of the Kendra is very much. Driven by this idea that we can internalize the Saffron Road, that there are strategic advantages to doing this and linking with the population as a whole. But in terms of the original question about the kind of ideology and how developed that is, I don't think the Kendra is that ideologically driven. I mean, it's not up there with movements like the VHP, or it doesn't have that kind of history. And I think its understanding of its commitment to Vivekananda, I think, is profound. I mean, they read Vivekananda differently from the Ramakrishnamata mission, but nothing I've seen leads me to think it's a purely exploitative reading.
To me, all this is brand new. Sorry for interrupting. But I was wondering, you mentioned Maharashtra as one of their centres, and then obviously Tamil Nadu with Kanyakumari.
Yeah.
But have they gotten all India presence and influence? And how do they numerically and actively, in terms of their service, compare with the Ramakrishnamurti mission? Is there a real kind of competition going on? Do you think they will overtake and really be much more influential nationally speaking than the Ramakrishnamurti mission?
Well, I think that's the question.
Yeah,
I think they are all India, but if you go on the website, there's a useful map which shows where they're concentrated, and there are heavy concentrations in Maharashtra, and it's said that one reason why they continued to work in Kanyakumari was because that was a district where the RSS previously had no influence. And so in developing what was initially an RSS presence through the campaign for the memorial, and then leaving this kind of offspring organisation, the Kendra there, was tactically quite an astute move. Of course, it's an area which has a high proportion, relatively speaking, of Indian Christians, and there have been communal problems down there, but none in which I can find the Kendra implicated. But the preoccupation with the northeast is interesting.
Well, could I take you up on that?
Yes.
That Maharashtra is a heartland for the Ambedkar Buddhist movement.
Yes.
Do they do any work with them? Because there seem to me to be overlaps.
I'm not aware of it. I wasn't aware of that. I've not spotted that. But I mean, I've been to some of their national events, they were prepared to give me lists of people who were attending, so I was able to break down where people came from and their ages. And I think it was quite interesting, again, the vast majority of those attending came from Maharashtra. But the second largest cohort, interestingly again, because of the distance, was from Arunachal Pradesh, and they were often actually life workers. They had come down to Kanyakumari to have, you know, what I kind of dubbed earlier the Kanyakumari experience, because it's, you know, it seemed to be a location which is redolent with associations with Vivekananda historically, but also in the great temples and you know, this notion of taking the darshan of the motherland from the very tip of mainland India. So I mean, those concentrations are very obvious, but I mean there is a kind of all India scattering of centres, but I think what they don't have, to the best of my knowledge, is I've tried to convey something at the scale of the operation of the Vivekananda Puram, which is a big operation, but I don't see anything rivaling some of the larger and more complex Ramakrishna mission centres I know well. I mean, like the ashram at Narendrapur outside Kolkata. I mean, that huge, so many different service wings. I mean, I think it lacks the complexity, it lacks the size, and indeed, of course, it lacks the status too. Although the Kendra has already attracted international awards for some of its work in education and indeed in sustainable development in particular. But I mean, the Ramakrishna Mission now has the Vivekananda University, which was accredited about 2 or 3 years ago. I mean, the Narendrapur Ashram is internationally recognised for its various work in visually impaired rural development training and all the rest of it. I think what the Kendra's doing is, at this stage, it's still more modest. And although on paper it has 5-6 times as many centres, I mean, many of these are volunteers, and you know, the Kendra's pattern is not like the RSS. They don't have daily meetings. They have monthly cycle of meetings, and they're meant to do outreach activities like offering yoga teaching to students and that kind of thing. So, I mean, there's a lot going on. And of course, you know, some of the missions and the mats as well are quite small, you know, one or two resident sannyasis, and that's about it. But overall, I would say that there isn't that maturity of institutional development yet. The only other place to look at, which I haven't been to yet, is the Vivekananda Kendra Institute of Culture, which is based in Arunachal Pradesh. And that again, is a big institution, running its own research projects into local cultures. Again, it's part of this trying to define Hindu identity and challenging the idea that some people living there are tribals and not Hindu. You know, are they Vanavasi or are they Adivasi? Are they tribals? No, they're Hindus. I mean, this is the argument going on there, and the Kendra's Institute there is very much trying to promote this idea of national unity through expanding the definition of Hinduism. So, I mean, I think there is a stronger ideological kind of development there. But you can't go back and find a body of work other than Vivekananda's which sustains this understanding of service.
On that note, I think we should we have to stop. Thank you so much for your lecture. I find it fascinating that there are people still alive who actually remember the great man himself.
What was this? In fact, the person I knew, sadly, now has died. Ashanda Krishnananda, who was the former secretary of the Ramakrishna Mission Institute of Culture. He was taught by Shimo, the chronicler of Sri Ramakrishna, and he went into the mat because he was so inspired. So, there is that kind of context. Indeed, I think it really does give it a kind of bite, and you really feel you can get your hands into something which is still being shaped.
Thank you so much. Thank you.